So we continue with another tale from the middle of the Gospel according to Luke. This is the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. So we hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at the rich man's gate lay a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who longed to satisfy his hunger with whatever fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs would come and lick the poor man's sores. It so happened that the poor man, Lazarus, died. He was carried away by the angels to be with Abraham. The rich man also died and was buried. In Hades, in the underworld, where the rich man was being tormented, he looked up, and in the distance he saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. The rich man called out, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me. Send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in agony in these flames." But Abraham said, "Child, remember that during your lifetime you received your good things, Lazarus in like manner evil things. But now he's comforted here, and you are in agony. Besides all this, between you and me, a great chasm has been fixed, so that those who might want to pass from here to you cannot do so. And no one can cross from there to us." The Gospel of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Sunset. This evening, this is the onset of Rosh Hashanah for our Jewish friends. So this is a high holy day for Jews for the next, it actually extends more than 24 hours. This is the, in effect, their new year. This is a new beginning. So they blow the shofar, the ram's horn, and then that signals the end of the end, and it's the beginning of the new. This is a time for self-examination. What am I here for? What is my purpose? What is my call? What's the value of life? It's a time to repair relationships. It's a time to renew commitments. It's a time to end a chapter. You turn the page and you have a brand new chapter. So it's a new beginning. It's a time of hope. It's a kind of a springtime hope, if you will, of newness. Rosh Hashanah is a grand celebration for Jews. Now we have this text from Luke on the parable. It also has been a time of renewal, a time of an end of chapter and a beginning of a chapter for many, many, many people whose lives, frankly, have been turned upside down by this one text. Probably one of the most notable examples is that of Albert Schweitzer, who, upon studying, reading, interpreting, applying this particular text, his life turned 180 degrees around. We know anything about Albert Schweitzer's life. A life that was, I'm sure, a life that was a good life in many ways for himself and others, but he became a kind of embodiment, if you will, of a Christ-like life, of a life lived for others, particularly known his ministries and his exploits, if you will, in places he had never even heard of, much less been down in Africa. This one text, amazing. It is an old text. It's actually it's an ancient Egyptian tale that has been adapted by many cultures over the centuries, and we find it here, placed in the middle of the New Testament, in right in the middle of the Gospel of Luke, the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, and it begins with just this certain rich man. We don't have any name for the rich man. But we do learn that his clothing is purple. Purple is the most expensive dye in the ancient world. It is basically afforded only by people in the high socioeconomic brackets. It is the color of the elite, and it's specifically the color of royalty. So people who have power, people who have authority, people who are the ones who are overseeing and governing society, it is purple. Well, if you take, for instance, the Roman Empire, even at this time, the emperor, in effect, is garbed in the purple. The emperor wears the purple. So when you see in this tale that Jesus is adapting from the ancient Egyptians, we have a rich man who is garbed in purple. We know where he goes. He is in the tippy-tippy top, whether it's the social elite or whether it's the political powers, but this is the tippy-tippy top. The food, we learn something about the food. He is dining sumptuously. So these are feasts. These are gourmet foods. These are the very best of whatever can be served every day. So this is somewhat, we might say, an eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you may die, kind of a lifestyle. Garbed in purple, dining sumptuously every day. And we learn something about his location. And of course, location is everything for property values. He lives in a gated community. A gated community in which one who wears the purple and dines sumptuously is highly likely to be someone who is living within an insulated world, probably with people of like kind, or at least people who are obedient or subservient to whatever his particular desires are. So we learn about the rich man. We also learn about one other character, and that is the poor man. Just the poor man. Oh, but he gets a name. The name is Lazarus. But now we've learned about his particular clothing. His clothing is sores. He is enveloped and garbed by sores. So he probably has infections that ooze pus. He wears his birthday suit that is adorned with sores. It is the dogs who come to lick the sores. Now, of course, you well know that dogs represent, when you read Kings and you read Samuels and you read many, many Old Testament texts, the Psalms, the prophecies, the dogs are in effect circling vultures, right? The dogs are there to eat the flesh and to gnaw the bones. So this poor man, Lazarus, who is garbed by sores, has dogs who are licking his wounds, waiting for the final breath. And then they have their gourmet feast of their particular style. We learn that his food apparently is non-existent. His food, he has to pray for daily bread. And the daily bread that he is hoping for is anything and everything that comes off of the rich man who is dining sumptuously, anything that comes off his table into the trash can somewhere. So this is our classic dumpster diver with the poor man named Lazarus. Pita bread is your eating utensils. You don't have forks, knives, spoon. Pita bread is what you use to dip in the food, and you may perhaps eat the pita bread, some of it, but a lot of it is thrown to the scraps. So he is, in effect, waiting to dine on the used eating utensils from those inside the gated community. Anything that would come would be a benefit and would nourish him. We learned about his location. He also is by the gated community, but he's outside the gate. He is lying by the gate. So he, in effect, is a beggar. So he has virtually nothing. He is dependent and waiting on the whims and the goodwill of others. Now, in this particular world, and pretty much throughout all cultures and humanity, even today, but in this particular world, if you are of the social and financial elite, you are experiencing the blessings of God for some good works or good deeds or good life. So these are blessings. If you are of the lower element, if you are poor, you're covered by sores and waiting for somebody's leftover eating utensils of pita bread, you obviously have sinned. You obviously have messed up somewhere your life, other people's life. You are experiencing the curses of God. That is the way people think in this particular time, and that's not so different from today. I mean, after all, this is, he goes into the category of waste, fraud, and abuse. He goes into the category of waiting for handouts from other people, whether it be churches or governments. This is an inactive beggar. This is not even a beggar who's doing anything. You'd think he could at least play a musical instrument, or he could perhaps maybe hand out pencils, or at least put out a tin cup. So this person in that particular world is going to clearly be labeled not just poor or a beggar, but definitely slothful, lazy, indigent, taking up space, taking up oxygen, waste. So the parable wants to paint stark extremes for us, which is what the ancient Egyptian tale, which you can read this in many cultures, and it's painted the same way. You just color it for that particular culture. So we have these two characters and these two extremes. The key is the gate. That's what opens up the parable. Can you go through the gate? Can you open the gate? So is the gate a closed gate or is it an open gate? Is it an open gate to welcome violence-fleeing asylum seekers? Or is it a closed gate to keep out people who are fleeing and looking for safety? Is it open or is it closed? Is it an open gate that is going to welcome and receive people? Or is it a closed gate that's a barrier that's going to be a security, a protection? That's what gates do. They either let you in or they keep you out. Apparently, for the gated community here, represented by the rich man, the people dressed in purple and fine linen, not the homespun, but the fine linen, dining sumptuously, apparently the gate is going to be one of security, one to keep out the riffraff. Whereas for the beggar is dependent and hoping that somehow or another the gate might open even a crack, that he can get some leftover eating utensils in the form of pita bread. Pause. Luke writes, and it so happened. It's kind of like just by chance. They die. Just seems to happen that these people died at some point in life, as though that was a surprise. It just happened that the poor man named Lazarus and the rich man died. Now, keep in mind, the poor man has a name, and names always mean something. The poor man's name is Lazarus, but we have an attitude that God helps those who help themselves, right? And he ain't helping himself. But the name Lazarus, we find out, is, it isn't that God helps those who help themselves. God helps those who cannot help themselves. And that's why he's named Lazarus, which means God helps, God supports, God favors, God upholds people like the poor man. So it so happened they died, and then we have the great equalizer of death, and then we get the great reversal. So as the story lays it out in this ancient tale, we find out that Lazarus, the one whom God helps, is now resting in the bosom of Abraham, and so we can see words of comfort, we can see words of joy, we can see words of maybe ecstasy, bliss, happiness, and then we find out that the rich man, the nameless rich man, is consigned, he is just buried, but he is consigned to Hades, underworld. This is a place or a state for departed spirits. This is apparently a place that you don't want to be, because it is noted that it is a place of torment, it's a place of flames, and of course this generates all sorts of silly and ridiculous notions of heaven and hell, and people with pitchforks and red clothes and whatnot. At any rate, we're painting extremes, so we have bliss and we have all this pain and torment, yes? All right. The rich man is obviously perhaps surprised, upset. We don't know. We don't want to psychologize the text. But he clearly is not enjoying himself. So, since he still doesn't get it, he pleads to Abraham, but he can see Abraham, he can see Lazarus, he can see, wow, cool water, maybe sumptuous feasts. Say, Abraham, can you send Lazarus with a little cup of cool water to just kind of, you know, wet my mouth a little bit? Now, if you're in a black congregation, the response is this. You have to read into the text. The response is this from Lazarus. Sir, you don't get it, do you? Because Lazarus ain't running no more errands for you. And in the black congregation, you're going to get a lot of amen, amen, amen. Aha, the great reversal. Death sort of has that kind of effect a little bit. Mortality is where we're all going, whether we recognize or accept or believe it or not. And whether you want to paint pictures of these extremes of heaven and hell, of bliss and torment, there is the great death. There is the great afterlife, whatever that is. Nobody knows. We have texts, and that's for another time and day when we talk about afterlife and resurrection. This text, though, is simply painting the great equalizer of death. When you begin to actually realize, I am going to die, I am going to not exist someday, and that's very, very difficult for a lot of people. It's next to impossible for a teenager. Virtually impossible for a 20 or 30 year old, but maybe it's at the magical age of 34. Somewhere you begin to say to yourself, wow, someday I'm not going to have the opportunity to come here on a Sunday morning at all. I'm going to be around. When you actually begin to realize your mortality, the end of the end of the end, and when you begin to accept that realization, that can now become the beginning of figuring out, wow, today could be the last day of my life. This could be the last day to repair relationships. This could be the last day to renew a commitment to serve others. There isn't a single one of us that can guarantee that we will wake up tomorrow and have another opportunity. God forbid that would occur, but there isn't a single one of us that can guarantee that. And if this life is going to end, I need to live today as though it is my last day on the face of this earth. Or else what was the point of life? Or was it just a bunch of atoms and molecules came together and some breathing and huffing and puffing and getting an award and doing, and that's it? That was what this was about? This is why God gave us the gift of life? No, this is the last day to renew relationships. This is the last day to restore, to serve others. When you really accept death, then every day is your last opportunity to plant seeds of kindness or peace and love, of compassion, This is the last opportunity today, because tomorrow may not be here. See, every day is like Rosh Hashanah, isn't it? Every day is Rosh Hashanah for not just Christians, but for all humans on the face of the earth. Carl Jung, Swiss psychiatrist, he encapsulated it this way. Our vocation, our call, our purpose is to wander through the world with a human heart for others in the name of Christ.